Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about suicide intervention. And this is understandably a difficult subject for many of our listeners. If this is something that's difficult for you, please turn off the radio or do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself. There are many places you can turn to for help. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. In the United States, suicide is the second most common cause of death for people ages 15 to 34. Over the past 20 years, we've seen an alarming rise in the occurrence of suicide, and in fact, the rate in Iowa has gone up more quickly than many other places in the nation. This hour, we're going to focus on developing skills for intervention, but throughout the hour, we do want to make it very clear that while intervention can be powerful and life-saving, it doesn't always work. There's no cure-all or foolproof plan. We're talking about best practices this hour. And today we've brought together a number of people who have been or are often called upon to intervene in a time of crisis. I'll talk with a police officer, a nurse, a pastor, and the director of a mobile crisis center, and I'll give them an opportunity to talk to each other. And we're going to start the hour with Officer Alton Poole, State Police Officer and Outreach Coordinator for the University of Iowa Department of Public Safety. Alton, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And in your role right now, this is not something, intervention with someone who is having suicidal thoughts is not something that you're commonly called upon to do, but this has been a big part of your career in the past. Can you tell me a little bit about maybe your first experience or one of your first experiences with that?
My first experience was in Ames. I started at the Iowa State University Police Department there. And I remember I was a patrol officer. I had only been on duty for 4 years. And then we get this call of a person on a ledge in a dorm, which was about 10 stories high. So I go to the call, and we have the paramedics there, we have fire there, and the idea was for me to talk to the person until a psychologist arrived to take over. So they tethered a rope to me, and I go out to the ledge, and I'm talking to this guy. And while I'm talking to the guy, the psychologist arrives, and he's listening. So then the command staff is like, okay, now it's time to make the transition. And the psychologist at the time was Dr. Gene Deisinger, who's the leading authority in threat assessment here in the United States. He said, no, leave him over there. Leave him out there. He's doing a good job. I was like, oh, okay. And there was a storm coming, so now the stakes are higher. And they're like, okay, you know, the winds are picking up. We're about 10 stories high. It's going to be, you know, a little dicey out there. And I'm sweating. And at one point, the guy lets go. And my heart dropped. And I caught him. And I pulled him back onto the ledge. But then I had to let go of his hand because I wanted him to come off the ledge of his own free will. I didn't want to, okay, now we're fighting on the
right,
ledge.
You didn't want to be in a position of physically forcing him.
Yes. And eventually he stepped off the ledge. And I was relieved. And Dr. Gene Deisinger said, you're a natural. And you fast forward, he started one of the first CIT, crisis intervention, there in the county, Story County. And he asked me to be a member on that team. And it was history ever since.
Wow. So that first intervention, had you had training as a police officer? Is that something that you had gone through in your training to know what to say to intervene?
Actually, and this was kind of unfortunate, and I might get a little emotional here. I was married at the time, and before I became a police officer, my ex-wife, she suffered from mental illness. And I had no clue what mental illness was. You know, you hear about it, you see stuff on TV, and now you're living with a person who suffers from severe depression with suicidal ideation, along with schizophrenia. And it's like being in the middle of the ocean and watching someone drown and not knowing what, you know, what kind of lifeline do you throw out to this person. And that interaction, that relationship, you pick up vicariously what to say and what not to say. It's like, okay, that was triggering. Don't ever say that again.
Right. A lot of trial and
error. So it wasn't until I started receiving formal training, things started making sense. I was like, oh, okay. That's why you're not supposed to say these things. So
this was something that, you ended up having to do professionally quite a few times, maybe not as dramatic as that time on the ledge, but this is something that you encountered again and again, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We had all kinds of calls. You're talking barricaded person with a weapon, person, you know, a jumper on a bridge, someone with a knife running in the middle of the street. And when I first came, I transferred here in 99. And at the time, I mean, we have a mutual aid agreement with the local law enforcement agencies. And some of the Iowa City police officers, you know, we talk, and they were aware that I had the training. And so a few times they called me. They're like, hey, is Officer Poole available? We have a person who is suicidal. And yeah.
Yeah. What kind of toll does that take on you personally? As I mentioned before, there's no cure. There's no foolproof plan to intervene. You'll have your successes, but you'll also have your failures. What kind of personal toll does that take on you?
It takes a huge toll. And I know that oftentimes the police are demonized, especially in the media, and we're seen as people that are uncaring. And for a lot of officers, at least the ones that I work with, that's far from the truth. And they have to take that home. And some of us, you know, depending on the case, you know, you just can't go home and open up to your wife or your kids and say, hey, guess what happened at work today?
Right.
A lot of the information is confidential, maybe an ongoing case. So, you know, who do we turn to? And that's why I think it's important to develop allies across the line in different fields. And that's how I met Rachel here. So it's nice to have other officers that are aware of the job and the trials and tribulations.
Yeah.
And these are people that you can talk to, or I can reach across the board and reach out to someone from another agency, an advocate.
You keep a hospital bracelet on your desk. Can you tell me the story behind that?
I told you about that. Anthony Iovino. He was part of the reason the mobile crisis unit started here in Johnson County. And this individual, I was called to a person taking off their clothes. And this was the dead of winter. And of course, my fear was that this person was going to die of hypothermia. So I had taken this person to a particular hospital. I don't want to throw him under the bus. And he was turned away. And at the time, I didn't have much resources in this county, because remember, I came from a different county,
right,
where we had built.
You had a network, yeah.
Right. And I stayed with this person for hours. And the only thing that I can come up with was, okay, I was originally called. This person was criminally trespassing, taking out their clothes. So I took the person to jail and to see. I said, okay, this is the situation. Yes, you know, he was criminally trespassing. However, I can't get him into a bed. And I need him to have a warm bed so we can assess. Well, he was eventually, you know, let go, and he was found dead under the bridge. And of course, the general public was like, oh my God, you know, no one cared, no one did anything for the person, not realizing that there was a lot going on in the background.
Right.
People were trying. It's just that partly we didn't know exactly what to do and weren't aware of all of the resources available. Unlike now, which is spin 180, we are more aware of resources, thanks to the development of the Mobile Crisis Unit.
Why do you keep his hospital bracelet on your desk?
As a reminder. That was the one that, you know, that was my biggest fear. You know, when you're in this line of work and you, I've been on many, many suicide or threat of suicide calls. And in the back of my mind, you know, I had anxiety because you care about these people. And my biggest fear was, you know, what if they, you know, follow through with their act and they're not here anymore. And in this case,
that's what happened.
He was no longer there anymore. And, you know, when you spend part of the day with this person, you develop a, you know, we were talking, we developed a relationship. He, it was no problem for me. He did anything I asked him to. He was a, I found out he was a veteran. You know, he was a great guy. He's just, he actually suffered from mental illness and he didn't have his medication. And that's what I was trying to do, get him medication. So to get him to a point or, a, you know, a sense of normalcy, whatever that is for him.
You have helped so many people. Do you have a reminder of that on your desk too? Do you have something that, that reminds you of the times that you've really made a difference?
Oh, I, this is, okay, it's kind of a weird story. I have a reminder that I walk around on all day. There was a call of a suicidal person, and I remember I took off running to my patrol car, and it was icy that day. And I slid on the ice and ended up under my patrol car, and I broke my leg.
So you carry that with you every single day. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about suicide intervention. And with me right now, Officer Alton Poole. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about suicide intervention. We're talking about best practices, and I'm visiting with a number of people who find themselves as first responders in situations where these skills are needed. I know that this is a difficult subject matter for a lot of people. If you have a hard time listening to this, do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And I also want to mention again, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. Just before the break, I was talking with Officer Alton Poole, state police officer and outreach coordinator for the University of Iowa Department of Public Safety. He left us hanging with a story about sliding under his car on ice and breaking his leg. That was a successful intervention, so he carries that reminder physically with him every single day. I want to turn now to another one of our first responders. Amy DeLay is a social worker and patient advocate at His Hands Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids. Amy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And maybe as a social worker at a free clinic, maybe that's not someone who a lot of us would think about immediately and thinking about someone who would be involved in suicide intervention and is a first responder in so many ways. But tell me a little bit about how this becomes part of your work.
Sure. So at our free clinic, we see a lot of people who have a lot of various barriers and things that they're facing. So we're always trying to keep in mind not just medically what's wrong within their blood pressure, their diabetes, but their social determinants of health. So what else can correspond with their health? And I remember picking up the phone one day and a gentleman wanted to make an appointment. And I said, oh, well, we're booked today. but we can see you tomorrow. What are we seeing you for? And he said, depression, but I'm not sure that I'll be around tomorrow for an appointment. So, of course, I assessed and made sure that he felt that he could safely get to our clinic. He didn't live very far away. And we worked him in, of course, immediately. And it turns out that he also had been without his medications for a long time. Insurance had lapsed. And so he was able to see one of our providers. We have a medication room at our clinic, so we were able to provide his medications for him, all those services at no cost. And then, of course, I sat down with him. We talked about some of the life pressures that he was feeling, what had kind of contributed to the fact that he was having suicidal ideations at the time. And we made a safety plan together. And at the end of the appointment, we actually didn't have to do a hospitalization or take him to the ER. The hope of having medication and knowing that that was a stabilizing factor for him in his mental health, and knowing that he had met people that cared, we were able to give the 24-hour crisis line and doing some follow-up daily for a while, and then after that, more sporadically. And now he continues to be a patient of ours. And we've been with them through some ups and downs with life trials, but nothing as dramatic as the day we first met him.
Yeah. In so many ways, I mean, you are trained to get people the help that they need in many different situations. That is an incredible challenge, and it gets to be more and more of a challenge as we've seen our healthcare system change. Did you, when you started this work, did you think that also suicide intervention might be a part of it?
No, I had no idea. I also really didn't realize how common it could be. How many people struggle silently, or how many people you can meet with that are maybe having suicidal ideations. I even met one woman at the clinic, and to be honest, I didn't know that she was suicidal. I didn't know that it was that bad. She never even saw a doctor. She just came in. I didn't know if her insurance was active, so she'd been off her meds for a while. And we were able to find out through calling her insurance that it was active, set up with her pharmacy. She already had her refills on order. And so she was able to get her medication that day. And I didn't really think it was that big of a deal until a few days later I got a card in the mail that said, thank you. You saved my life. I don't know if I'd still be alive if I didn't have my medication, if you had to help me get my medication. So it was such a quick thing. She was maybe in the office for a half an hour. But that was a real reminder to me to remember to take the time to dig deeper with people, because what I thought was just a simple, oh, you need your meds, I didn't really realize how much she was suffering, how great her depression was at the time.
Absolutely. And later in the hour, when we're all talking with each other, we're going to spend more time talking about some of the signs that somebody needs help. But what an incredibly important reminder that a lot of people don't ask for help or don't know how to ask for the help that they really need. That must be something that, you work with every day in your line of work.
Yes, I've learned through trainings not to be afraid to just ask someone, you know, point blank, is that something that you're considering, or have you ever thought about it? And I think sometimes people think, oh, you put them on the spot, or maybe you'll make them think more about it, right, or you drive them to take action on it. But really, the reactions that I've gotten in through the trainings that people have shared is that people open up and they're almost relieved that there's a safe place, someone that they can talk to that isn't going to judge them or think that they need to immediately drive to the ER and have a hospitalization, but that we can really start to process through what are they going on, what are their strengths, where does their hope lie, and where's a support network and a safety net for them.
I'm talking with Amy DeLay, a social worker and patient advocate at His Hands Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids. She's also going to stay with us, and I want to bring Pastor Erling Schultz of United Methodist Church in Iowa Falls into the conversation. Pastor Schultz, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And now we've been talking so far with people in pretty urban environments. Iowa Falls, as we know, is a pretty small town. And so in a community like Iowa Falls, and I'm sure pastors everywhere also find themselves on the front lines in responding to things, but in a community like Iowa Falls, where you're also dealing with a rural population, does that put you in a position of being more of a first responder than maybe you ever thought you would be?
Fulfilling your call to pastoral ministry, you have some understanding that you're going to meet people in all stages and places of life. But I have found that the real key when you meet people in their vulnerability is to be prepared to be aware of your surroundings. Like we've really noticed in our agricultural community, the suicide rates have really jumped the last number of years, and just need to be aware of what it is that's building towards that, the stresses that they're under, and just a general awareness of what's going on in the community. What are the stresses? What are the anxieties? And being prepared to talk with them on a realistic and a hopeful basis.
We did a program a couple of years ago about the high rates of suicide among farmers. And one of the real challenges that we talked about on that show is that so many people in the agricultural community, we have sort of a culture of not sharing our feelings, of not talking about what we're feeling. How do you deal with that challenge?
Well, the first thing we try to do, and I work with communities of faith, so I'm not in this by myself, but the number one thing that we try to do is create a space that's trustful, create a space that's peaceful, create a space in which they have the opportunity to talk. But it's also that you do need to learn those correct questions to ask to try and crack the shell on the outside. And that can be tough with the agricultural community.
Absolutely.
They're not used to opening up so readily.
What kind of mental health training have you had? Again, not something that is probably part of your theological training.
It doesn't come through our theological training, but the denomination does set up training from time to time to talk about mental illness. In fact, the Iowa United Methodist Church 2 years ago set up a mental health task force to talk about how we can respond to the growing crisis and how the faith communities can be involved. So there is some training involved, but we also know here at the table that a lot of that training is very generalized, right? But the situations are never generalized. Each situation is very individual. So you have to... it's like Halton was sharing. It's training by fire, by conversation and relationship.
You have had enough experience with this and have been moved to share your message, written about it, published it. What do you think people need to know? What are you trying to do in raising awareness about this crisis?
One, we need to, again, create that space in which conversation can happen. And to create that space, we need to be aware of our surroundings. We need to be aware of our circumstances. We need to be aware of our fellow church members or community members. And we need to be willing to talk about it. Thankfully, in my lifetime, I've seen the stigma of suicide and mental health reduce somewhat. But we're also still hesitant to talk about it. We just need to be more courageous in speaking to one another.
How do you see your role? If someone comes to you and says that they are having suicidal thoughts, I mean, that is a moment of crisis. What can you do to help them, and how do you help them connect with other kinds of help?
Good question. Number one, I carry with me a message of hope, and it's a hope that I've realized in my own life overcoming alcohol, substance abuse, and finding that hope in my own life that there is something else out there, and sharing with them that hope, that foundation of faith. But in the end, it is being aware of the resources that are available right there in the community or the county. Helping them set up the appointments or finding the persons that they need to talk to, assisting them in making that appointment and getting there. Sometimes it's just holding hands. Sometimes it's just sharing eye contact, right? To see them. Like I like to say, see them with Jesus' eyes and hear them with Jesus' ears.
We are talking about suicide intervention this hour with me, Pastor Erling Schultz of United Methodist Church in Iowa Falls. And I want to bring the final member of our group here into the conversation. Rochelle Honey Arsement is Director of Mobile Crisis Outreach and Community in Iowa City. And Rochelle, the reason we have this group of people here with us today is because you have brought them together before as part of the Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, or ASSIST, something that you've all been part of. And I want to start with that question. I think a lot of us hear about crisis intervention and think about people who are trained to intervene in crises, but we don't think about all the people who are just going to be there, who need to intervene because they are the person who's there. So tell me a little bit about the genesis of bringing these people together.
Yeah, so a few months ago, we had an applied suicide intervention skills training that had a wide variety of participants in it. The diversity of that group was phenomenal. We had police officers, nurses, faith-based folks. We had a pretty good variety of races and ages and genders. It was just a really phenomenal experience. And the depth of the conversation that took place in that ASSIST was just far more than many of the other ones that I've done. And so it really showed that not just professionals are the ones who need this kind of training. We're not always the first people who come in contact with someone. It's often friends or family. It's religious leaders. Law enforcement is often one of the first responders. It's teachers. I do a lot with the school district here in Iowa City. It's not always who we think of. But also those that we do think about who should have training in suicide don't always have that training. I have my master's in social work, and I didn't really get much training in my master's program on how to intervene with suicide. And so that's what we're trying to do at Community Crisis Services, is we're trying to get this kind of training out to the public so that we can have more people who will be touch points in people's lives. So we train lay people all the time on how to intervene when someone's at risk, and how to see, recognize those signs, and ask the question.
I've asked everyone else to share their personal story, so tell me yours. How did you come to this work?
Yes, so I have a lot of lived experience with mental health issues myself. Many years of what's called schizoaffective disorder, so psychosis and bipolar symptoms. I'm doing really, really well at this point, and but it's been, recovery is not a straight line. It's certainly a winding path with all of that, and it's taken a lot of hard work. In 2016, I graduated with a second master's degree in health and disability rights. And I had become involved in the conversation about the Access Center. I'm not sure if people are familiar with that term, but it's sort of a one-stop shop for mental health and substance abuse crises. So Johnson County, along with some other communities in the state, are developing these access centers where people can go instead of having to go to the emergency room or go to jail. And so I became involved in the discussions around that, and through that found out about the job at what was then the Crisis Center and is now Community Crisis Services with Mobile Crisis. And so I applied to that and was hired, and have fallen in love. That was 3 years ago, and I've been running the program now for 2.5 years. And I love that what we get to do. We really don't have a lot of people over us telling us what we can and can't do. We get to go out and meet the person where they're at in the community and really do what they're needing in that moment, really being with the person and helping them to recognize that they have worth and dignity, and that there are people who recognize that worth and dignity.
We have a break coming up here in just a moment, but I want to ask you about, it's kind of a big topic, so we may need to continue after the break. When you're teaching people about suicide intervention, as I mentioned earlier, there's no cure. There's no foolproof plan. We all want to be able to fix this problem. Is that a danger, something that you worry about, that people will blame themselves if they try to intervene, but it doesn't work?
Yeah, we talk a lot about that in our trainings, it's certainly something that keeps people sometimes from asking the question, right? Because if somebody says yes, then you're like, what do I do? How do I keep this person safe? And one of the things that we talk about in Assist is keeping the person safe for now, right? That we're not going to try to solve all of their problems in this moment. We don't have to keep them alive for the next 2 to 3 decades. We have to keep them alive for right now. Get them through this moment. Get them through this crisis that they're in right now. And then we follow up with folks with mobile crisis. We stay connected. But it certainly is a fear that people have, and we work through that. And to know that, you know, we don't have control with what people do after we let them out of, you know, go. But right. It's that idea of keeping them safe for now.
Rochelle Honey Arsamit is director of mobile crisis outreach at Community in Iowa City. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about suicide intervention, and we've brought together people from a number of different walks of life who find themselves being first responders in times of personal crisis. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. If this is something you've had an experience with, or if you have a question, you're welcome to give us a call at 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I also want to mention again, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And of course, there are resources in every county or community in Iowa. You can find out a great deal more online if this is something you need help with or someone in your life needs assistance. Please look for the help that is nearby. With me this hour, I have Officer Alton Poole, State Police Officer and Outreach Coordinator for the University of Iowa Department of Public Safety. Amy DeLay is here, Social Worker and Patient Advocate at his Hands-Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids. Pastor Erling Schultz of United Methodist Church in Iowa Falls. And Rochelle Honey Arsamit, Director of Mobile Crisis Outreach at Community in Iowa City. And I want to talk about language here for a moment, because Amy, earlier you were talking about how early in your time as a social worker, you were afraid to ask the question, are you having suicidal thoughts? And so, Rochelle, and then I'd love everybody else to share some of their experience. I think we're so afraid to talk about suicide. And we also know that publicizing suicide in the media, that kind of thing, can spark suicidal thoughts in others. So give me some guidelines for how we can talk about it and how, if you are concerned about somebody, you should approach it.
Yes. So we absolutely need to be able to ask the question, right? And I think a lot of people are afraid because we are afraid. What do we do if someone says, yes, I am thinking about suicide? That's why we need to know the resources available to us and to know how to get somebody to the help that they need. But I do think language is really important. We need to be able to get beyond some of the barriers that people have in talking about mental health and about mental illness and about suicide. I think a lot of what I try to do with mobile crisis is that genuineness, right? And talking with folks to make them feel more comfortable being with me and discussing that topic. I lean a lot internally on my own experience and what has helped me in the past. And I lean a lot on my own internal experience when I train people as well with mobile crisis and with the Assist training. And so language is very important in how we speak with people, being direct, you know, not mincing our words and talking about, are you thinking of hurting yourself? We want to make sure that we know, are they thinking of killing themselves or are they thinking of suicide? Because the idea of hurting themselves, sometimes people self-harm and it's not really about suicide. And sometimes people, when they are thinking about suicide, don't see suicide as hurting themselves. So we have to be really specific when we're asking that question. And then allowing people to really talk about what's led them to this situation, what's really gotten them there, and allow them to sort of be in that muck and being in that muck with them. And that's what really can help people find that hope and to know that there's somebody who's willing to be there and have that conversation and to sit with them in their pain.
Yeah, I also think that just beyond having the language and the courage to ask the question is to be aware of how you ask that question, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Too many people in faith communities ask that question with a sense of judgment. You're not committing suicide, are you? Right? You know. That's a no-no, right? So what's your stance? What's your body language as you ask that question? Is it a stance of comfort? Is it a stance of compassion? I think that's important.
Absolutely. Being aware of our own attitudes about suicide is really, really important to know. And so that if we have judgments, that, you know, we try to work on that so that we don't have those judgments, but also that we're not conveying those judgments to the person who's thinking about suicide. They're already judging themselves. They're already living in enormous amounts of shame. We don't need to be adding that to them when we're trying to help them get out of this crisis that they're in. We need to be able to show them that we care and that we're here for them. Suicide is often about isolation. Even people who may be surrounded by lots of people feel isolated because they may not feel like they can talk about what's really going on. And if we can show them that there is a community that's willing to sit with them and be with them and support them, then we can often bring people out of that crisis.
Amy, what are... Oh, I'm sorry.
You bring up a question that I had for the panel, right? Because we do find in those who are contemplating suicide, isolation is a big part of it. Even in this world of social media and Twitter and Facebook and all of that, we still feel very isolated. I work in a place in which we have communities already set up. So as you encounter those who are considering or under stress, what kind of communities or what kind of connections do you try and make to combat that isolation?
Who wants to respond to that? Alton?
That connection starts with you. Part of my training is hostage negotiation. You find information that are similar across the board. We were taught that 92% of the time, the person is, you know, just wants to be heard. Or another way to rephrase that, or reframe that, they want to be seen. And so one of the key training that that they talked about in ASSIST that we also do in CIT is active listening. You know, there's a part in the ASSIST training where they have to tell their story. Well, if you don't know how to listen to their story and receive it, they're not going to feel like they're being heard. They're going to shut down. So,
well, I think a lot of us, our first instinct is the opposite of that, to say, no, 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 you're not alone.
You're absolutely right.
And so actually being an active listener, accepting them where they're at, is a really important part of this response.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the key component of active listening is, of course, not passing judgment and not trying to actively give advice. You shut your mouth. Shut your trap. Just listen.
That's not easy. Not easy. Amy, you have something to add?
Yes, and I think that in today's day and age where people are isolated, having someone that sits down that genuinely cares, people can tell when you're doing it just because it's your job that you clock in, you know, 9 to 5,
oh,
or when you're sitting down and you truly care. And I think that that touches people. I think as well, a common theme is that people who are having suicidal ideations feel like they're a burden to others. So to see they're not actually a burden, there are people out there who genuinely, truly care about them. And then to go back to your question, Pastor, in addition, I always, when making a safety plan, though it starts with me, I agree with Alton, then we go further and we explore who are their friends, who are their family, their social network. Being a faith-based nonprofit, we also can see if church is something that they're interested in, and being a part of a faith community and help get them plugged in that way, if that's something that they
because
think would.
Because you can't be there every moment. You can't give, you can't create the community just yourself.
Right. It's about having a number of people that come together, and that helps them see too. They have strength, they have worth, they have dignity, and that gives them hope. I love that I have that plaque on my wall that says hope, and I love that I think every one of us have said the word hope.
I want to get to the phones here, but Rochelle, I want to give you just 20 seconds to mention that as well, because here you are, you know, intervening in a moment of crisis, but how do you give them the key to a sustained community?
So I think it's really listening to their story, listening to who they have in their life right now, what are they interested in, what have they been interested in the past, you know, and helping them to drive that conversation, giving them that power, and then working with them to find ways to build that community from their interests, from the things that have given them passion in the past. How do you reconnect with that passion? And so it's really working as a team with that individual when they're, you know, when once we get them through this immediate crisis, to connect them with resources. We have lots of resources that we do connect with in mobile crisis, including faith-based, but also just many different communities, peer support in our community with those with lived experience. We have a place here in Iowa City called Our Place, run through NAMI, which is a peer drop-in center, which we recommend to almost every single one of our clients.
Let's go to the phones. Lusha is on the line in Brooklyn. Hello, Lusha.
Hi, it's Lusha.
Oh,
thank
Lusha.
You.
I'm sorry about that. And I know your son died by suicide just recently. Share a little bit of your story with us. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much. Well, he lived in Africa with his wife. And we knew that there was some depression. We'd been kind of concerned. We'd been in contact long distance all the time. But he basically, it's kind of graphic, but he was a wildlife conservation person, loved the African bush, loved the animals. And he basically walked into the bush and fed his body to the wildlife, to the predators. Very, very, very difficult for us back here in Iowa. But what I wanted to say to your listeners and to your panel is that for us, because we called it what it was, his wife very quickly told the world that it was suicide, that gave us the permission to call it what it was. Because we were able to be honest, our whole support community, our family, friends, everyone were able to support us just wonderfully. We just felt lifted up.
Oh, Lusha.
I think that the things that your panel is talking about are just as important for survivors. The points that they're making about being good listeners, about caring, about showing love, respect to another person, not stigmatizing, has just made all the difference in the world to us. And we feel just surrounded by love from his childhood friends, even from people in all around the world who have comforted us.
Oh, Lusha, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you have that community and that support. Thank you for sharing your story with us today. And again, I'm so sorry that you've had to go through this. Rochelle, you wanted to respond to what Lusha was saying.
Yes, Lusha, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. I'm so sorry for your loss. Absolutely, those who have lost loved ones to suicide are very much in need of our support. At Community Crisis Services, we do have a suicide loss support group for those individuals who have lost someone to suicide. And I think it is phenomenal that that his wife, that your daughter-in-law, was able to be willing to be open about the fact that he died by suicide, because so many people don't talk about it when it happens, and then we don't know how common it is. We don't have that community to support us when we have that. Mental illness and suicide are not sort of those casserole dish kinds of illnesses where if you or someone in your family gets cancer, you know, people bring casseroles, they come around us and they support us. But when we have these illnesses, often that's not the case. And I'm really glad to hear that in this situation that support is there. But if we talk about it more and we support one another, I think it can become a casserole dish illness where we can support one another and be there.
Yeah, otherwise, the guilt and the shame that's felt by those who are left can be just debilitating in themselves and lead to other mental stresses. And I probably deal with survivors more than I deal with those who are. And the number one thing is to be realistic and be open, be honest.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I do want to talk about survivors for a moment, whether it's a person who has had thoughts about suicide in the past but did not take their life, or survived an attempt, or someone in their family. This is something that lasts. You know, the thoughts, the guilt, the anger, the shame. Mm. And as Lucia was saying, talking about it takes away some of that stigma. But give me a little bit of advice for survivors, whatever kind of survivor they are, for a way to move forward. Alton, can you give me a little bit of advice moving forward?
Well, just talking. No, so don't be afraid to reach out to friends, family, and if they are so inclined, reach out to professional counselors, like psychologists, a social worker, a pastor. Yeah.
And I also think that for those who survive this, either an attempt or otherwise, that then to be an advocate for the next person, right? I find in the faith community, those people are excellent resources to help me in my own counseling or help me in the struggles that others are having. And then that gives them a purpose to their life. And while there's never a purpose to suicide, it does give them some meaning to carry that forward, to help others out in the similar situations.
Amy, do you have anything to add?
I think that you said it, beautifully, just to be open to discussing and then seeing how can I use this to inspire someone else to speak out? How can I use this to ease someone else's pain or to let them know that it's okay to say that you need help? I always tell people it's okay to not be okay.
And Rochelle, I think for so many people, this has been, if it's something they've been through, it is a dark secret that they carry. They don't tell people. They don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we as a society, in spite of the fact that the risk of suicide seems to be increasing, are we getting better at responding?
I think in some areas we are. In some communities we are. There's still a pretty big stigma out there in certain groups and in certain parts of society. But I do think we are making progress. There's more listening to the lived experience voice out there by professionals to see what it was really like for those who have lost someone to suicide, what it's really like for those who have attempted suicide themselves. And that's giving the research and the knowledge more depth and to hear the lived experience of those who have thought of suicide.
Rochelle Honey Arsement, thank you.
Thank you.
Rochelle Honey Arsement, Director of Mobile Crisis Outreach at Community Crisis Services in Iowa City. Also with us today, Pastor Erling Schultz of United Methodist Church in Iowa Falls, Amy DeLay, social worker and patient advocate at His Hands Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids, Officer Alton Poole, state police officer and outreach coordinator for the University of Iowa Department of Public Safety. And again, National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. This is Talk of Iowa.